From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, some big-name musicians launch a lobbying organization to protect singers and songwriters. Then, when the co-creators of the Hulu series Pen 15 first pitched their comedy about life in middle school, they were met with a fair amount of resistance.
We got a lot of, I'm nauseous, I don't want to go back there, please stop.
Yeah.
My kids are in middle school, I don't want to think about that. Great, thank you for your time.
And two filmmakers tell us about documenting America's immigration detention system. All that coming up on The Frame. The music industry changes almost by the minute. Thanks to the internet and all kinds of streaming services, these days it's a lot more complicated to figure out who gets paid for what. While listeners are really good at adapting to the latest music platform, the laws that govern them aren't quite so fast to catch up. Now, some music industry superstars, including Dave Matthews and Anderson .Paak, have formed the Music Artists Coalition. It's a new Washington, D.C. outfit that will lobby for musicians' rights. I spoke with reporter Lucas Shaw, who broke the story for Bloomberg, and he explained how musicians often have to rely on the federal government.
Unlike a lot of other creative industries, the federal government has a huge role in affecting how artists, and especially how the songwriters, get compensated from all sorts of different parties. So you either have judges or laws or some other government bodies determining how songwriters get paid by radio stations, by bars, by restaurants, by streaming services, you know, Pandora, Spotify, Apple, you name it. And even last year, Congress passed a new act called the Music Modernization Act that also affected a lot of the royalty collections involving artists. So the relationship between the music industry and Washington is very tight. And artists are looking to make sure that, you know, their voice is heard whenever new laws and bills are being proposed.
The Music Modernization Act went through a lot of iterations and was not easy to get passed. Do recording artists feel that there were things that were either cut out of that act or could have been stronger? Are they hoping that there might be other kinds of legislation going forward?
You know, when I spoke with Irving Azoff, who's a manager to everybody from Travis Scott to the Eagles, to Dead & Company, or at least involved in working with all of them, he said that he felt the bill was, quote, net neutral, that it wasn't a bad thing, but if that was the best effort to make things easier and better for artists, it didn't change a whole lot. But I do think that this is as much about what's coming next as what has already happened, because the fact is that every year or two, it seems that there is some new issue involving artists in Washington, and there are certain laws that are currently on the books that they would love to see changed if there was any way. You know, for example, from an old telecommunications act that created the idea of safe harbor, which is what allows a lot of free music to proliferate on YouTube, that they would love to get rid of.
And the other complicating factor is there are different licenses that apply based on how a song is used. There is the mechanical license, which is the license to copy and distribute the composition. And there's the sound recording, which is the performance of that song. Is that part of the problem, too, that rights and royalties are pretty complicated once you start taking them apart?
Yeah, I sometimes get confused explaining music rights to myself or to editors when I have to say, you know, you have the recording, which is the musical performer, you have the publisher, which is the songwriter, and then within both of those, you have, to your point, mechanical performers. There's just so many different rights. It can be very hard to keep track of, very hard to know what is what. And the fact is that most artists don't know these things. They're not keeping tabs, and so they are relying on intermediaries, whether it's agents or publishers or labels, to keep track of this for them. But the idea behind this new kind of company or this new lobbying group is we need professionally minded folks who understand the intricacies of the music business and can advocate on artists' behalf in D.C. and make sure that there's no kind of contrasting desires. Because the fact is that labels and publishers often have kind of different goals than artists. They obviously all want the music to be listened to, but if the label can keep a little more of the money than the artist is going to keep, they're probably going to do that.
We're talking with Lucas Shaw at Bloomberg about a new lobbying effort by musicians. Dave Matthews, I suspect, is not really hurting when it comes to whatever he's paid. How much of what artists like Dave Matthews are doing are for himself and maybe for other lesser known, less powerful artists? Are they trying to work for all songwriters and performers?
I think it's a little bit of both. So I've been told that Dave Matthews, for example, is very upset that there's so much bootleg merchandise available on Amazon. Fans will pay for any new T-shirt or concert DVD or anything like that. And if somebody else is uploading it to Amazon, Dave Matthews is there saying, well, why should some other person get money that should really go to me and to my bandmates? Though he's got lots of money, part of it is fighting the bootlegging. But I do think you're right that, you know, the names that have signed up for this, Dave Matthews Band, Don Henley, Maren Morris, Anderson .Paak, these are big stars. And when they say they're getting behind an issue, that forces other people to pay attention and come to the table. And it makes it easier for them to look out for the little guy.
It also strikes me as a little bit odd that one of the people who is involved in this is Irving Azoff. And people who have been around the music business know that Irving has been, he's been a manager, he's been a promoter. It does feel like he is almost on the other side of this equation. Where are Irving Azoff's priorities aligned with that of some of the artists?
I mean, look, Irving has had almost every job in the music business. He ran Live Nation Ticketmaster. He ran a record label. But I think the through line through his career has, for the most part, been standing up for the artist. And in particular, in this later phase of his career, he has tried, whether self-interested or not, to kind of fight for artist rights and artists getting more money in the face of, you know, large tech companies playing, the consolidation of record labels. You know, Irving Azoff came of age in the music industry that looked a lot different than it did today. It was a lot more diffuse. You had more different labels. You had more different sellers. Now they're just a handful of companies that can control things. And so Irving has sort of made it his cri de coeur to be, say, that giant for some of these artists.
And one of the overriding complications, I assume, is the rise of streaming services. So let's just say I pay $10 to go into a bar. They're streaming Spotify. There's a song by the Eagles. Is that part of the problem, that figuring out that kind of calculation in a digital era is incredibly complicated?
A lot of people feel like the streaming economy has been built, for example, is to the detriment of the songwriters. And that's just one of many ways that when you have a new type of economy, because it has in the shift from CDs to iTunes and now to streaming, there's both opportunity and peril, and who collects the spoils.
Lucas Shaw covers media, technology, and entertainment for Bloomberg. Lucas, always great to have you on the show.
Great to be back. Thanks, John.
Coming up on The Frame, the creators of the painfully awkward and hilarious TV series Pen 15 have an Emmy nomination, and that's no surprise. If I asked you to name the times of your life that you look back on fondly, I'd venture to guess that middle school would not be very high on the list. The series Pen 15 doesn't put any polish on the awkwardness of those years, but it's still very funny, and it has paid off with an Emmy nomination for Outstanding Writing in a Comedy Series. So we're going to revisit my conversation with its creators, who also star in the Hulu series. Maya Erskine and Anna Conkle are both in their 30s, but they play 13-year-old versions of themselves in the show. Erskine and Conkle met in college studying theater at NYU. When the two came by the studio, we talked about how their friendship later turned into a creative partnership. Here's Anna Conkle.
I think in that moment, it was really more, are you terrified? I'm terrified, and connecting through that. And as time went by, there was definitely just a similar point of view. We're both oversharers. We both find comedy in sad things and our trauma and shame. And that was a relief to meet somebody else like that. And it felt, she's so funny. Maya's so funny.
That's how I felt about you.
And honest. And so, yeah, I was immediately like hoping she would be my friend.
When you are in seventh grade, everything that happens feels like it is the worst thing that could possibly happen. It's very hard to have any perspective on the moment.
Right,
when you're adults, you can look back and go, what was I thinking? But when you're in that moment, you don't have that perspective.
It's life or death.
It is. And it's horrible, and it's soul-crushing, and it's heartbreaking, and all of those things that go with it. When you have the perspective of age, how does that change the way that you want to reflect upon what these characters don't have the perspective to understand?
I mean, something that you're touching on that we thought was really funny was the idea that the littlest thing can feel like your world is crashing. And for my character, for example, like her hairs in the front of her face being out of place and being obsessive about that, that there's something sad, but that's also really funny.
Right.
And yeah, there was sort of in the finding the thong, that's the popular girl's thong, and or just seeing the thong. You know, like I remember that being a moment when I was 13 and seeing that someone had a thong through the top of their jeans and going like, something just changed inside me.
Oh my God.
What?
Heather's wearing a thong.
Oh my God, no way.
Yeah. Even just the scene with my dad where he's teaching me how to play drums on a laundry basket.
So, start playing.
Okay, just don't say it like that.
I didn't say it like anything.
Yes, you did. Can you just shut up for a second? Because I was about to play and you're messing me up.
Maya, just come on.
I remember going to this carnal place of pure anger and frustration that my dad was telling me how to hit the drums.
You know, let me show you.
This is why I didn't want to do this.
If you can't play for me, how are you going to play for everyone else?
I don't know, because not everyone's in like a professional Steely Dan cover band, Dad.
And they never will be if they don't know how to practice.
Oh, no! Not this song tomorrow night because of you!
Oh, fine. It's all because of me.
Fine.
I looked at you wrong.
Yeah, you did.
The scream that I scream is probably a real scream that I screamed with my parents. And my brother edited this part of the show, and he said he had PTSD watching that.
Both of your characters have a lot of crushes, some mostly unfulfilled. But it does ultimately seem to be about a love story about the two of you and about how trauma brings people closer together. So I want to play a clip from early in the season where you find out that Maya, you've been named Eugis, the ugliest girl in school.
I am ugly. I'm a freaking freak. Like, I'm Eugis.
Maya, if Eugis means beautiful unicorn, then yeah, you are Eugis. Then yeah, you are.
No, not. Do you understand? Like, I'm the ugliest girl in school. Do you get that in your skull? Like, to love me is the biggest insult. Like, that's what it means.
Then I guess, you know, I've been insulted the greatest.
It's a beautiful scene, but it's really... I mean, I'm crying. But it's real. I mean, it's what anybody that age goes through, mostly girls, because boys don't talk about their feelings at that age. But I want to ask you about that scene and why it was so important in the series and what it reflects about the intention of what you're trying to create here.
I think that the feeling of what happens when you are feeling like a reject in your life in any capacity that I think we both can relate to then and now, and what gets you through it. And I think Maya and I were both kind of blessed with a friend at that time, and that still is our friend, that we got to lean on to feel like we were capable of getting through it. And I think had I been alone, I don't know what path I would have taken. It would have been a different path when things got really dark and hard at times, which, you know, that's life. And so we want to honor that.
We're talking with Maya Erskine and Anna Conkle about their series, Pen 15. When you were thinking about what this series meant and how you're kind of pitching it around, it's the kind of thing where you would typically get pushback. It's like, do they have to be like that? Do they have to do that? Do they have to talk about these things? What were the conversations you had with people as you're taking this series out to make sure that they were on the same page with you? And what were the typical things you heard in rejection that maybe even convince you that what you were doing was right?
Well, even before we started pitching, because before we pitched it, we had a 15-minute pilot presentation that we filmed as an experiment. And even before that, we went around talking about the idea to executives, and they would just, you know, say, I just don't know how this is going to work. This is inappropriate. You got to have all adults play the kids, or it should be all kids. The idea of you two with kids, I don't see how that's going to work. Or you should have a bunch of celebrities play the guest stars who come in as their middle school selves. And, you know, we got a lot of that.
And the reservations were understandable.
Totally.
And then we're in such beginning stages to try to describe, no, directorially, we're going to do the shots. You know, everyone's like, what? What are you talking about?
And then when we would pitch it, you know, we only pitched to three places, but definitely one of them. We got a lot of, I'm nauseous. I don't want to go back there. Please stop.
Please stop talking about that. Yeah.
My kids are in middle school. I don't want to think about that. Great. Totally understand. Thank you for your time.
Episode 3, you guys talk about masturbation and about the shame that goes with that. Mm-hmm. And then how, if you actually figure it out, it's not that shameful and it can be a really good thing. So when you're thinking about the things that happen, but also that are instructive for people who might be watching, what were the kinds of messages that you want to make sure that you are representing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that episode was something, you know, many episodes throughout came from conversations of like, what's my secret? Like, what are our secrets? And we have the luxury that like Maya knows my secrets and I know hers. And so it came from that place of, okay, this is a scary thing to share. We have each other in real life. Let's do it. You know, and that's another reason why not to give these stories to somebody else, because it was like pretty intense at times going through it, and funny and fulfilling and all those other things that we were so lucky for. But yeah, I mean, Maya was so brave to do that. And I was so grateful to her that you were willing to like go there.
I felt very strongly, and I'm thankful to you as well for supporting me in it, of just sharing that story, because I felt so alone and I still to this day feel alone in it because no one talks about it. And, you know, I just wanted to normalize the conversation around it.
And like in real life, in my middle school years, I wasn't masturbating, but there was a rumor that when, no, I wish I was missing out. Are you kidding? But there was a rumor that went around about me that I was, and I was like, I felt crippled. But also I was harassed. I mean, as a lot of us are, for
slut shamed.
Oh yeah, like there were signs put up. There were like, I was a slut. And then with guys, it was like funny. It was fodder. So it was really exciting to me. Maya was so honest and funny with it also, that like she was willing to make it real and funny.
Let me ask this last thing. There are obviously physical things you do to make sure that your young actors aren't put in situations that they might be uncomfortable. There's a kissing scene where I think you use a double. Were there any scenes emotionally where they felt they needed to have some guidance, or where they had ideas about how kids their age might react in that situation?
We tried to talk through things a lot, probably. And you know that age, like no one wants to talk through things.
Right.
So it was
right.
Like such a weird, I felt like their parent is, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I remember even there's just a scene where Taj Cross, who's an amazing actor, he plays Sam. He's supposed to look at my character as if he's falling in love with her. And I had to pull him aside and have a conversation before to just make sure he felt comfortable with it. He understood it. It was just acting. And he was so wise and hip to it. He's like, I got it. Yeah. It's good.
And he looked. And he did. And he did it.
Yeah. And I was like, I'm so sorry you're looking at my face. Please imagine someone else that is in your class. And, you know.
Maya Erskine and Anna Conkle are the co-creators and stars of Pen 15. It's on Hulu now. Thank you guys so much for coming.
Oh my gosh. Thanks for
having us.
Thank you.
Next on The Frame, two filmmakers explore a detention facility to battle deportation from the inside. The Infiltrators is part documentary and part dramatization about America's vast deportation infrastructure and the lives it affects. We caught up with the people who made The Infiltrators at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year, where the movie premiered, and they told us about following a group of young undocumented immigrants, so-called dreamers, who are fighting for others facing deportation.
I'm Alex Rivera, a filmmaker and occasionally digital media artist.
I'm Christina Ibarra. I am a filmmaker, and my film is The Infiltrators.
Everyone needs a plan. That's what my mom told me as she was carrying me north, across the border. Everyone needs a plan.
So The Infiltrators tells a true story of a small group of undocumented youth, folks that are sometimes called dreamers, back in 2010. And this group started to form around the Dream Act, and then they started to work on stopping deportations. And at a certain point, they decided that the best place for them to do this work of stopping deportations was inside of a detention center.
They called Broward a model detention center. Minimum security, TVs in every room. Like a Florida motel, but you can't check out.
And so at the beginning of the film, you meet these characters, you meet this group, and you watch as they decide to get detained and go through this process of basically getting arrested by the Border Patrol on purpose to go into a detention center to help get people out. And so it's kind of a political heist, a jailbreak movie in reverse, and it's a true story.
The infiltrators, once inside, work with their collaborators, a team of undocumented youth working from a safe house about 30 miles away. And once they get the safe house gets a call, they start working a case. And the way they do that is they get background information on the case, find out what district they're in so that they can figure out what lawmaker to call, what Congress member to call, to create a political pressure, a campaign to try to release them.
There's a lot of different ways that people can stay and a lot of different things that a detainee can do to delay a deportation. And so that's part of what the infiltration is about, is getting that information in.
I'm working with a group and we're trying to get people out of here. Just wondering if I can give you their number.
Get people out?
How? Well, how'd you end up in here?
So stupid, man. I don't have a driver's license. So I was riding my bike on the sidewalk and I get stopped by the cops.
One of the main characters is Marco Saavedra, who was the first infiltrator at Broward. He went in knowing one thing about this detention center, which was that there was a man inside named Claudio Rojas. And the Rojas family had reached out to the National Immigrant Youth Alliance for help. Claudio, the father in the family, had been detained, and lawyers and everyone else told the family, I'm sorry, there's no hope. Under the Obama administration, there was this kind of rhetoric about targeting the deportation apparatus at felons, etc., you know, the baddest people, the gangbangers, so, you know, all that. But they were deporting almost 400,000 people a year. And are those really all felons? Clearly not. And Claudio on the inside was saying, there's no felons in here. This detention center is filled with everyday moms and dads. And so the activists went there to find him, to try to get him out and to expose what was really a systematic problem.
The infiltrators are almost like forcing themselves into a space that doesn't want them in. Like they have this strong sense of belonging that is very, it's very American, but yet they're not seen that way. And so it creates this kind of this creative resistance that comes from that place where they are. I love that sense of belonging that they carry. It's something that sometimes I feel I don't have, you know?
There's a lot of things I love about the world of the film, like that we enter through dreamers that speak English, they're very Americanized, they're immediately identifiable, but their action is in a sense about their parents. It's about the generation above them, the immigrants who are not Americanized, the immigrants who arrived recently, the immigrants who were rounded up in workplace raids or caught at a stop sign for not having a driver's license, the people who are swept up in this giant deportation machine.
In every family, I have been able to see my own family. And that's sacred. Family is sacred. What would I want someone to do for my family?
That the dreamers are kind of using their privilege, is what they call it, to enter this system and try to rescue the people who were broadly unsympathetic in this current moment, you know, and that kind of solidarity between the young generation and the old, hacking at this contradiction in our political culture, where sort of dreamers are sort of seen as sympathetic, but their parents are seen as criminals, that they're throwing their bodies at that contradiction, I think is really dramatic and provocative and, you know, could be explored in a much longer format and a bigger canvas than what we had in a 90-minute film.
Oftentimes we are used to just accepting things that we feel are not ethical or humane because that's just the way things are. And one of the things that meeting the infiltrators did for me is it reminded me that we should question what is unethical.
The Infiltrators opens the Los Angeles Latino International Film Festival, which kicks off August 31st at the TCL Chinese Theater in Hollywood. For more information, check out latinofilm.org. And before we go, we want to mark the passing of Los Angeles musician Roz G. He was an influential producer, vocalist, and beatmaker who co-founded Brain Feeder Records with Flying Lotus. Roz G was a key part of a scene that drew other beatmakers and fans to clubs in L.A. Roz G's real name was Gregory Shorter. The Los Angeles Times reports that he'd been struggling with health issues, including diabetes and pneumonia. Roz G died on Monday at the age of 39. That's our show for today. I'm John Horn in the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC. We're back here tomorrow.